Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host today, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined today with Mr. Caleb Avery, who is the CEO and founder of Tilled. We're going to learn all about payment facilitation as a service today. I know that sounds like really weird and probably boring as hell, but it's going to be an interesting conversation, I promise. We're going to learn about how to make money from taking other people's money. I don't know, maybe that's not the right way to describe it, but I have a feeling Caleb's going to correct me in a second. But I do want to remind you that today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult. Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably and has the platform to help you manage that team. Visit Fullscale.io to learn more. Caleb, welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on today and excited to talk more about helping people make money from collecting other people's money. I think that's how you put it, but excited to talk more about it.
Is that the right definition?
I would say those are not the words that I would use, but the general idea is that we help software companies monetize the payments that are flowing through their platform. So when they're helping their end customers collect payments, they're generating money on every dollar processed through the platform.
So let me provide an example. So we own a company called Gigabook that does online scheduling. And let's say our customer is a yoga studio or whatever, and they charge $50 for their classes or whatever. We could use a software like yours, and then we could make, 1% of that $50 or something like that, right? Like, that's kind of the general idea behind it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we work with vertical software companies and essentially every conceivable vertical, that you can imagine, scheduling software being a great example where, for me, the experience was really starting to consult for a lot of these software companies that typically were using Stripe or Braintree. Because it was easy. 7 lines of code, you've got Stripe implemented, within your payment software. And the problem for those software companies is, yes, it's easy. Yes, it's frictionless, but you're also leaving a lot of money on the table. And so, in that example of the $50, payment, maybe leaving, whatever it is, 50 cents, on the table isn't that exciting. But what if that software company is processing $100 million a year in payments collectively across hundreds of locations? All of a sudden, then you're talking about, potentially $1 million in revenue, that you're leaving on the table. And I think that's, where Tilled comes in, is really offering, these software companies at scale that ability to create what can be a very sizable, revenue stream for their business, potentially doubling the revenue that these companies are making on each one of their customers.
So I have that exact scenario with the $100 million, and maybe we're going to figure it out during this episode, how you're going to make me like $1 million a year off of that. I'm excited. But before we get to that part of the conversation, how in the world did you get into this?
Yeah. So I started out in the payment space at 19 years old, going door to door, selling payment processing services to small business owners. And so originally, you know, starting out doing door to door, over time scaled out that business. And then I started consulting for software companies. And most of the software businesses that I was consulting with were doing anywhere from $100 million to over $1 billion of annual processing volume. And for me, the really eye-opening experience was starting to consult for these larger organizations, $500 million, $700 million, $1 billion in payments volume. And most of them really had marginally more knowledge of payments than your average merchant. And that was a pretty eye-opening experience for me. And after a couple of years of doing that work, I realized that there really wasn't a great alternative option outside of a Stripe or a Braintree, especially from a technology perspective, available to these software companies. And so most of them were starting to work with the legacy gateways like NMI or Authorize.net and the traditional, you know, ISO payment acquirers, and they were accepting a really subpar experience. I mean, for your software company, you know, do you want to email out a PDF application, you know, to your customers and wait a week, you know, to get them onboarded and then give them a reporting console that looks like it was built in 1997? The answer is no. You know, that's not the experience, you know, that you want. So that's why so many companies.
Wait a second. Authorize.net was super high tech 20 years ago when I started using it.
It looks about the same. I mean, it's a fantastic,
it was super,
you know, piece
high
of
tech
software.
Then. It's because I used it then.
Give it reliable.
yeah. Things changed a lot, and it's a big difference where, like, so my old companies, we're a SaaS company, and people pay us, no big deal. We used Authorize.net and whatever, and we collected our money. But that's not really the scenario that you're really built for, right? The scenario you're built for is, you know, I have a scheduling system and I have 1,000 customers use my scheduling system. So then that's 1,000 accounts. That's like, yes, that would be like 1,000 authorized.net accounts to set up. It's not one. It's like lots of them, right? And that's why it needed a totally different solution. Is that part of what made Stripe, what was so the big deal about Stripe? Was it that sort of use case for them too?
Yeah, when you look at that B2B2B sale. So for us, we're selling to, you know, you as the software company who has to then go sell to, you know, that end merchant. It really comes down to creating that frictionless experience for you to go convert, you know, that end customer onto, you know, the payment platform. And I think that's what Stripe got right initially. And so, you know, if you kind of wind back the clock, you know, whatever, 12, 13 years, you know, pre-Stripe, you know, you're going and you're creating an authorized.net account, you're sending them a PDF, you know, merchant application. It's this really friction-filled process to onboard, you know, each one of those downstream customers. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, if you look back, you know, 13 years ago, there weren't a lot of vertical software applications, you know, for small business owners. That wasn't the primary way that SMBs were getting access to, you know, payment acceptance for their business. Whereas, you know, over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, especially, you've seen this massive rise in SaaS in general, but vertical software, you know, more specifically. And Stripe was able to really come in and offer, you know, this turnkey solution for vertical software companies that wanted to add that embedded payment experience for their clients. And it really can be a value add part, you know, the equation, where for that scheduling software, I mean, is the solution even really complete if you can't collect the payment, you know, from the end customer? And I think for a lot of software, you know, solutions, embedded payments has become such a necessary part, you know, of the equation that they really emphasize very heavily on the technology and the merchant experience, until is really one of the first solutions that's come to market and allowed you to have that modern, easy to implement technology, to have a great and frictionless merchant experience, but also to add the third very important element of payment monetization, so that you can create that recurring revenue stream. And, you know, now your business can add, you know, an extra $1 million a year in revenue, instead of giving that away to Stripe.
Well, and I love that. And I love that, you know, there's companies I've heard before, there are companies that, like, their entire revenue model is predicated on this, right? It's like they almost give their software away from free, and they make money off of these transaction fees. And that could very well be somebody like Square and you know, Shopify or like a lot of these different big things like that, right? Like they make a huge part of their revenue is just on these little fees that are almost hidden fees, which could monetize the entire thing. And, you know, I think the problem that you guys are trying to solve is making that available for the littler guys, right? Like maybe Shopify figured out how to do that and that's their business model, but being able to give that same capability to smaller companies, small and mid-market companies is probably, you know, the heart of what you do.
It's certainly at the core of it, especially the original thesis behind Tilled. So for me, when I was doing some of this consulting work, one of the clients was doing about $1 billion a year in volume. And they really thought that they wanted to go become a registered PayFac themselves. And so, you know, when you look at Stripe, Square, Braintree, PayPal, all of these guys are registered payment facilitators. And to your point, you know, when you're the scale of Toast or Service Titan, you know, you can afford to go become a registered PayFac and build all of this out, you know, internally, because you're doing $40 billion a year, you know, in payments volume. But for, you know, the average software business doing 20, 50, 100, 500 million a year, you know, in payments volume, it's really not practical for you to go become a registered PayFac, at least, you know, as the world exists today. And so the original thesis behind Tilled, before we ever wrote a line of code, before it was ever called Tilled, before we came up with PayFac as a service, the original hypothesis was what would have to be true for a vertical software business to leverage the benefits of the PayFac model, but launch in 1 week. And so that was the original, you know, thought behind Tilled, was if we could get that time to market down to 1 week, we could open up the possibilities for essentially every software company out there to be able to integrate and monetize the payments flowing through their platform.
So every time I hear the word payments, the first thing I think of is fraud. So that has to be like the biggest thorn in your side, right? Like, isn't that the biggest thorn in everyone's side in the payment space?
It's certainly something that is top of mind for us. And for me, you know, I started this at this point 4.5 years ago as a solo founder. And for me, one of the original questions that I had to, one of the original hurdles that I had to get through was convincing our first banking partners and our first acquiring partners to agree to this model of PayFac as a service, where they had no contractual relationship. They've never spoken to the software company. They have no relationship, you know, to the merchants. And that took me about 11 months to figure out, you know, how to put all the pieces together and get the messaging right to convince, you know, these very, you know, slow moving legacy institutions that there was a new way and a new path, you know, forward. And for us, the way that I was able to get them comfortable with it was thinking about it as a multi-stage underwriting process, where we start by actually underwriting and vetting the software platform itself. And so, you know, for your scheduling software, what types of merchants, what types of industries are you targeting? What's the average ticket? What's the high ticket? What's the average monthly processing volume per merchant? Is it online? Is it card present? Is there ACH processing? If you have a history of processing payments with Stripe, show us your chargeback rate. Show us the, you know, the history that can get us comfortable, you know, with this business. And that was the first line of defense, because the goal with the actual merchant onboarding process is that we're auto approving these clients. So 3 minutes automated process to get, you know, all of your sub merchants onboarded onto the platform. And so we have to go through this initial vetting process, you know, with the software companies, and that kind of multi-step underwriting process was really the key to getting, you know, our initial banking and acquiring partners comfortable with the new model.
Well, a good example of this is, so I have a blog that's on Substack, and it's blog.visionaryCTO.com, and I have paid subscribers, right? But to get the payments, I had to set up, like, I think it was a Stripe account. And so to your point, like, there are these platforms like that, and Substack is a good example of one. There's a lot of examples of them, and it's like you have to vet somebody like Substack and say, okay, do we see that as a good business? But that would be very different if you're like, okay, we have Substack on one hand, and you're like, hey, we have OnlyFans on the other one, which is very similar. Like, people pay $5 a month to view this content or whatever, right? And so then you have to say, okay, do we want to do this kind of business or this kind of business? And the fraud and all the stuff that goes with it. And so those are two very different equations, right? And so but ultimately, did you guys have to guarantee part of that, or the fraud, or like how did you have to overcome some of that?
Yeah, certainly. So I think one of the friction points when you look at the PayFac model is historically, the software company, a Toast or ServiceTitan, that's going and becoming the registered PayFac themselves, is taking on all of the liability for all of the transactions and
Yeah.
potential fraud and chargebacks that happen on, all of the downstream, merchant accounts that they're creating. And, for earlier stage software companies that don't have a full-time underwriting and risk monitoring
Yeah.
team, would they even be comfortable taking on the risk? And the general answer was no. And so for us at Tild, we knew very early on that we were going to have to take on, a lot of that liability in order to be able to get our customers to sign up and come on to Tild, because the whole premise was you're going to be up and running in a week, you're not hiring a team, you're not taking on, liability. And so that inherently creates additional risk for us. But we have approached that with a combination of hiring experienced personnel that have experience in the space, but equally importantly, technology. And so we have implemented a variety of both in-house proprietary tooling as well as third-party tooling that allow us to not only upfront, vet the ISVs and the merchants coming onto the platform and run all the automated KYC, KYB, bank verifications. Like an example this week is that we just rolled out Plaid within our merchant onboarding process. And so a merchant onboarding onto Tild can instantly verify their bank details by logging into, their bank account using Plaid. And these are just the types of examples of ways that, we continue to take friction out of the merchant onboarding process, because you have to verify the bank details. The options available are something like Plaid, or you're collecting, voided checks or bank letters. Obviously, Plaid is going to be a lot less friction than, hey, do you have a bank letter, signed by your bank that you can upload, into this application process, or fax or email, that over to us. And so constantly trying to find ways to, add new technology elements to streamline that boarding experience, but also reduce, some of the fraud and reduce some of the risk that we're taking on in the process.
Well, so in the early days of this, you had to take on all the risk. Like, do you have some sleepless nights of like, if we pick the wrong vendor and they get all these chargebacks, like we're on the hook for this? Or like, was there some sleepless nights and all of that too?
I think every startup founder can attest that there are always sleepless nights at every stage, from
Dude,
early
I'm right
stage to
there. I'm
scaling
there
up.
right now.
Yeah, and there's a lot of days where you're making these decisions, and they're bet the company decisions. And so I think the reality of just the DNA, of folks like ourselves that are crazy enough, to be entrepreneurs, we're generally more, risk prone individuals, where it's like, look, these are the risks that you have to take to achieve, anything meaningful, in life. And so absolutely there were sleepless nights, absolutely there were risks, taken in the early days, and there's always those kind of bet the company, moments. And we're still standing 4.5, years later, which I think, is a testament to judgment and a little bit of luck along the way.
Yeah, it's just a little, I mean, so, at your point, every startup has, a lot of stress and all those moments in it, but it's even harder where it's like, for what you're talking about, it's also out of your control, right? Like, hey, we decided to do business with this scheduling platform, and all of a sudden we're on the hook for fraud and all these things if they do something stupid. So that's like a whole nother level. But I just started a new company, and I think we signed up our first paying customer today. And
Congratulations.
I got a lot of shit that has to be done really fast. And so I may have some sleepless nights because I have too much work to do. Like, this is maybe insane soon, but yeah, it's fun times.
It really is. And I feel like, for me, I've started couple of companies during my career. And the reality is as much stress as there is in the early days, there's also a lot of fun. It's a very different experience in the early days, where you get to wear multiple hats, you're making a lot of the decisions yourself, and you're really directly involved in every aspect, of the business day to day. Whereas, as you scale up the business to the level that, Tild is today, the day to day looks very different, for me as a CEO versus, I consider kind of the early days when you're in that founder, mindset. It's a very different mindset. It's a very different day to day than when you really transition to that
Yeah.
CEO role.
How many employees do you have today?
A little over 50
Yeah.
on the team today, spread out all across the country.
you've got just enough that they become a giant pain in the neck.
Luckily, we've got a phenomenal team and a great leadership team, around me. But it's a lot of fun.
You get to the size where it just, no matter what, you got that many employees, you're just gonna have crazy problems that just happen. It's just the fun of having employees. So
it creates different challenges, and I feel like, for me, one of the things that I've really, been working hard to level up is my communication. It's one thing when you got 3 employees, you can communicate directly, to all 3 people, and there's not a lot of room for miscommunication. When you get up to 50 people, especially in a distributed, environment, you really have to focus on, clear communication, and creating the opportunity to effectively communicate out those messages and give people the opportunities to ask questions as well.
Well, I do want to remind everybody that finding expert software developers doesn't have to be difficult, especially when you visit fullscale.io, where you can build a software team quickly and affordably. Use the Fullscale platform to define your needs and see what developers are available to do. See what developers are available today to join your team. Visit fullscale.io to learn more. So tell me, is your company fully remote, or you guys are based in Boulder?
So we are based in Boulder, Colorado. We do have an office. I'm calling in from the podcast studio here in the Boulder office. We've actually got a lot of folks, probably got, 12 or 13 people in the office today. But on any given day, I might be alone, or there might be 2 or 3 people in the office. And so we are primarily a remote first organization, okay, even for those of us that live, locally here in Colorado. And I think the reality is a lot of that's a byproduct of when the business started. So, as I mentioned earlier, 4.5 years old, but when COVID happened, we were only 3 employees. And so the reality is, the vast majority of the team, was hired after COVID. And so I don't feel like initially the plan was this, remote organization, but as we started making the first couple of hires, back in 2020, there wasn't as much of a reason to kind of force ourselves and constrain ourselves to hire, locally within the Boulder area. And so we fairly quickly pivoted to just, hey, let's find the best possible people to fill every role in the organization. And so, fast forward, a year later, we were, a couple dozen people, on the team, and we were distributed, and now have continued to scale, the organization remotely. But COVID was definitely a major factor in that decision-making process.
So you mentioned before you are a solo founder. So I'd love to learn a little more about that. And obviously you're, 3-4 years into this now. And what is it like to be a solo founder, especially back then? Starting out, like how this had to be way, way harder as a solo founder. I was a solo founder before, and I feel like it's so much harder.
Yeah, I definitely have a special level of empathy for any solo founders out there. The reality is it can definitely be, a lonely journey. In the early days, you don't have the sounding board. It's really just you relying on yourself and your, judgment and decision-making capacity in the early days. I think for me, the reason why I went, the route that I did, I knew there were some pretty severe, both technical and regulatory hurdles that we needed to get over to even see if the business was viable. And so for me, I had a young kid at the time. We had a second on the way. And so I didn't want to be pouring a ton of money into a business before I knew if it was really a viable opportunity. And for me, it took longer than I would have anticipated to clear some of those initial hurdles, which I think is a pretty common, experience for folks, in the early days. But it was about 11 months before I ended up bringing on, our first full-time hire into Till, as we started to clear some of those early hurdles. And I really was convinced that the opportunity in the business, had legs. And this is something that I just felt compelled to kind of will into existence and bring to life.
Well, and so I'm curious, you're not a software developer, right? Like that part's not of it. Is not your trade, right?
Correct.
So how did you deal with that part of it early on of like, okay, we have to figure out how to integrate with all these different credit card networkings, banking, processing, all this stuff. Like, obviously there's a lot of shit to figure out there. So how did you navigate that part of it early on?
Yeah, so initially we started by bringing in third-party developers to help write the early MVP version, you know, of the solution and validate that this was, you know, technically possible. And candidly, that wasn't a phenomenal experience. I think part of that's probably the fact that I was a non-technical founder. And one of the things that I learned through that process was you really have to be maniacal about the product management side of, you know, the requirements and really clearly defining the expectations with the developers, because largely they built, you know, what was asked of them. We just weren't asking them to build, you know, the right things. And, you know, probably, I don't know, 18 months or so into the journey, we ended up bringing on a VP of engineering that became our CTO, and he started building out the team. And I think that was really the turning point for us, where, you know, really started to understand the importance of product management in that engineering life cycle. And I really took, you know, full ownership of the product side of the business in the early days. And once we had the kind of product and engineering minds, more balanced till that was really when the product started to take shape.
Well, and that's why I wanted to dig into this. I think there's a lot of people out there like yourself that, you know, have great business ideas, entrepreneurs, but they're not technical. And, you know, you said it, you're like, you relied on some third-party developers to help you build this thing, but it sounds like you were still missing the kind of lead developer architect, right? That knew how to like build the software. It's like, it's pretty easy to find developers that you tell them what to do and they can do it, but there's still got to be somebody that understands the product vision, not just the product vision part of it, like in the company vision, but the technical vision of like, how do we actually build software? Like, how do we actually like architect this thing, right? And you were missing that component, and it sounded like it took you kind of limped through that for 18 months until you hired somebody that was able to bring that.
Yeah, we made more progress in probably 6 months than we did in 18 months.
Yeah.
When we had the right, team in place. And I think for me, you know, that's been, you know, one of the things that I've learned just time and time again, that having the right people around you really is just critical, to the success, you know, of what you're building. It's all well and good to, be a solo founder and have, you know, a great idea, but it's pretty hard to bring, you know, a business like Tilled to life, by yourself. You have to have just an incredible group of people around you that believe in the mission, the vision for where you're headed, and then have the capacity to execute, you know, on that vision. And, you know, I've been fortunate to surround myself with some incredible people that are excited about what we're building, and it's really helped, you know, bring Tilled to life.
So going back, you know, from the very beginning of this, do you wish you had a co-founder?
Absolutely. No hesitation on that one. I think if there's one thing that I could change, it would be, you know, bringing somebody on in the early days. I think we'd be a lot further along, in 4.5 years. But the reality is I don't regret the journey. You learn these things along the way, and we're right where we need to be, you know, today to capitalize on this opportunity. But if I build another business, I certainly, you know, hope that I'm able to find, that kind of yin to my yang that can be that co-founder to really scale up the business right out of the gates.
Well, you mentioned, you know, hiring that VP of engineering was a really key hire to you. And what's interesting about companies is as companies grow, there become other opportunities where, not really opportunities, but like moments in time where there's some other key hire that becomes super critical, right? Like you get to this point now, you're like, well, we really need some other like VP of operations or VP of sales or biz dev or whatever. And have you went through some of those moments as well, where it's like become other things all of a sudden are like a huge issue? Like we need somebody that can figure out how to figure this shit out and go do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely been multiple cases, you know, of that over the last 4.5 years. I think in the early days, when I look at, you know, some of the initial key, you know, whether it was director or VP, you know, hires that we made, it was largely offloading things from my plate. And so, you know, in the early days, when you're the founder of the business, you're doing sales, you're doing marketing, I'm doing product. And so you HR, finance, like all of these things are happening amongst, you know, one or two or three, you know, people. But as the organization starts to scale, I think the initial big decision is kind of the order to make those hires in. So, hey, VP of engineering, you know, for us was, I think, hire number four. And so getting that order right, where you're bringing in, you know, the VP of engineering and then the VP of marketing and then, you know, the director of sales and figuring out that order, I think is important. But I also think there's a timing element as well, where you have to really look at, you know, hey, what am I, you know, as the founder, you know, uniquely good at? What should I be doing at this stage, you know, of the business? And what is Tilled the business best served by bringing in a subject matter expert that can really focus on whatever that key, you know, aspect of the business, sales, marketing, engineering, customer success, you know, HR, finance, you name it. And making those decisions at the right point in time, I think can often be difficult for founders, because you're oftentimes giving up things that you enjoy doing.
Yeah.
You might even be good at it. So if you enjoy it and you're good at it, actually delegating and giving up control, you know, of that function can be difficult, but it is a prerequisite to scaling the organization to give up the control, to delegate the authority and find, you know, smarter people that can scale up those functions much better than, you know, 1/10 of my energy. Find somebody that can put 100% of their energy, you know, towards that function day in and day out.
Well, first of all, if I was you, the first thing I would have hired somebody and delegated it about would have been the freaking compliance and the fraud. you go figure out this crap. Like, I don't want to deal with this. But I'm going to guess you had many sleepless nights trying to figure that crap out. That had to be the worst of it.
It was definitely one of the harder parts in the early days was really going through that conversation, but it felt like something that I needed to do. And the reality was it was an iterative process. So, you know, go have a conversation with a bank, go have a conversation with, you know, an acquirer or processor, and just get the feedback from them. Like, hey, I hear what you're saying, but I have concerns about, you know, X, Y, and Z. Okay, back to the drawing board. Let me figure out, you know, the pieces of the puzzle, rearrange them, change the story, go back. Okay, well, how would you feel if here's how, you know, we structured it? Well, this little piece is still off. And I think for me, I felt more comfortable in the early days working through that iterative process myself than delegating that, at least at that very early stage.
Okay, you ready to get into my $100 million problem?
Let's do it.
Okay, so I work for a digital marketing agency, and so we have hundreds of customers, and they spend $100 million a year on advertising on Google and stuff. So I'm trying to figure out, how do I make my percentage of that along the way, right? They're paying Google, and, you know, I get their credit card numbers and I got to log into Google or whatever. So how do I get my cut? I'm trying to figure out. I have like $1 million, dude. I'll make $1 million in this podcast if we can figure this out.
Everybody would like to have me as a guest on their podcast. If I could figure out, every single host gets, you know, an extra $1 million.
Yes.
In revenue. So in this example, you're saying that your customers for the digital marketing agency are giving you their credit card numbers, but then you're
putting into Google.
You're inputting their credit card number into Google. I am sorry to say, I'm not sure that there is the opportunity here for you guys to make, you know, the $1 million there. So Google's processing let's dig in a little deeper. So Google's processing the credit card payments for you guys in this example. And Google's, well, I think the credit card processing fee.
I think the solution to this is I would have to ACH my customers, and then I use like my own virtual card or something that I give Google, and then I could make the 1% off of that or something like that.
That would be more, you know, on the issuing side, with you getting the credit card rewards for making the payments, which is still a potential opportunity, you know, for you guys. And so there is still an opportunity for you guys to potentially, you know, make some money on that from the credit card rewards, but not quite the same way, you know, that Tilled, you know, helps our software clients, unfortunately.
Well, there might be a next big idea for you is trying to figure out how to help digital marketing agencies do that. So
now maybe, you got my brain turning.
Yeah. So what other kinds of, ideas do you guys have, like product wise? What are you guys working on?
Yeah. So for us at Tild, our mission has always been to empower software companies to monetize the payments flowing through their platform. And initially we were doing that directly with software companies. They were coming inbound, largely organic, to Tild based on seeing us on LinkedIn, hearing me on podcasts, whatever method that they were coming in. More recently, we've been getting a lot of interest from ISOs, agents, payments consultants, folks from, their traditional payments landscape that want to refer, software companies to Tild. And so over the last year or so, that's been a major part, of the business. But going forward, we're starting to see a lot of interest from the larger, direct acquirers coming to us saying, hey, is there an opportunity for you guys to actually white label the entire Tild solution and go sell that, through, their distribution channels? We actually had one of the acquirers in our office, earlier today. But for them, they're coming at this where the traditional, door-to-door sales model that I started my payments career in is largely the growth is slowing. And increasingly, this vertical software opportunity is becoming the fastest growing segment within the payments ecosystem. And so for us, with the ISV at the center of our universe, we're really focusing on, the distribution model. And there's some pretty key, product, build out requirements for us to basically create that next level of the white label of the Tild solution. So it's not just a white label of our consoles, it's a full white label of our API. And that was a really interesting, whiteboard conversation with our CTO saying like, hey, like, what would it take to go a layer up and white label kind of the Tild portion, of the product? But, fortunately we had, back to your point about architecture, we had some of these conversations, three plus years ago, when Matt joined saying, hey, I think there could over time be this opportunity, to expand the offering in this way. Let's make sure that, we're always thinking about white label as a first class citizen, within the Tild architecture. And so I had challenged the team probably about 4 months ago. I said, hey, I've got a big demo, coming up. What would it take to have, let's have it in staging. I'm not saying in the production environment. What would it take in the staging environment to have a demo of the entire Tild platform white labeled, for this large acquirer? And they're like, well, how much time do we have? And I'm like, well, the demo's next Thursday. And they're like, we're going to do it. And they were able to, go get it done, which was a pretty incredible, feat for them. But it all came back to us, making some of those, functional, architectural decisions in the early days that enabled us to make, these quick pivots and open up these opportunities in the business.
So when people use debit cards through this type of processing, do the vendors still able to get the fees, or there's no fees on the debit cards?
There's the opportunity to earn revenue on essentially every payment, flowing through the platform, whether it's credit, debit, ACH. I think let's take a specific, use case where you've got a golf course, management platform selling to, golf courses. And so they're allowing you to reserve your tee time, online. Hey, it's $100 to reserve that tee time. Whether the end user pays by a credit or a debit card, there's still $100, being collected. And for the golf course management platform, when they're setting the pricing to that golf course, some of them set it as a flat rate price, which is more common with folks like Stripe. So 2.9% and 30 cents to that golf course, regardless of what type, of card is processed. And in that example, if you're using a debit card, that's actually substantially more profitable for the software company. So, the golf course is paying 2.9% and 30 cents, and it may only cost, let's say 10 basis points and 28 cents or something to process, that debit card. There is a lot of margin, on the table. There's a couple dollars of margin, on the table. So a couple percent, to be made on that debit card transaction. More, we're seeing folks implementing Interchange Plus pricing, And so in that interchange plus model, you know, you're giving the merchant interchange plus, let's say, 40 basis points, regardless of whether it's a credit or a debit card. Okay. And so in that example, regardless of whether it's a credit card or a debit card, you're still making, you know, 40 basis points on a given transaction. But yeah, a debit card plus flat rate pricing is kind of the holy grail for margin, at least in my world.
So how do you guys do business in Europe, or is it just North America?
So today we are live in the US and Canada, and that includes, you know, in-person, online, ACH, EFT. We do all sorts of payment acceptance methods in the US and Canada. We definitely have aspirations to continue to grow the business internationally. Certainly in a lot of the conversations that we're having with the larger, you know, public acquirers, some of these folks are active in 150 countries. And so, you know, when they're coming to us, they're saying, hey, can we use you guys, you know, at least the technology layer at Tilled in every geography, you know, that we operate in. And so there's certainly additional complexity, you know, that comes with operating internationally, but a lot of it is the licensing and compliance requirements. And so if we're operating in more of a, you know, technology or gateway layer, it does reduce some of the scope for us to be able to go operate internationally, where a lot of the folks that are looking to partner with us already have the licenses, already have the compliance teams, already have, you know, that in place. What they're missing is the API, the consoles, okay, that software company functionality, which a lot of that there's certainly commonality in different geographies.
Okay, that's awesome. Yeah, when I look up online, like the interchange fees in Europe are pretty dramatically less than the US, right? Because I feel like that would affect your business in some ways too.
Yeah, I think, you know, practically speaking, the interchange costs are really not a factor in our margin. So we're not actually making money on the interchange itself. Those are really the pass-through costs, you know, to the banks, the acquirers, the card brands involved, but certainly lower margin for those folks, you know, over in Europe with a lot of the capped interchange, you know, that exists, but there's still opportunity to monetize payments, you know, for software companies over there.
Absolutely. Well, if you need to hire software engineers, testers, or leaders, FullScale can help. We have the people and the platform to help you build and manage a team of experts. When you visit fullscale.io, all you need to do is answer a few questions and let our platform match you up with our fully vetted, highly experienced team of software engineers. At FullScale, we specialize in building a long-term team that works only for you. Learn more when you visit fullscale.io. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And, you know, as we end the show, I always love to ask if you have any final words of wisdom for other entrepreneurs out there. Besides finding a co-founder.
finding a co-founder is definitely, you know, up there in terms of my advice. I think, you know, second bit of advice would really be to focus on the culture, you know, the organization that you're creating. I think for too many entrepreneurs, they wait too long to really put direct emphasis on the culture of the business. I think you have to think about, you know, culture as early on in the business as you can, because it can pay tremendous dividends if you can get that piece of the business right early on.
Awesome. That's great advice. Well, this is Caleb Avery with Tilled, and thank you so much for being on the show today. And that was awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Matt, really appreciate the opportunity to share my story. And if anybody wants to learn more, certainly you can check us out at tilled.com. I'm also very active on LinkedIn. So follow me, Caleb Avery, on LinkedIn. But thank you for the opportunity.
Awesome. Thank you.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by FullScale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.